I would like to call the Jobs, Agriculture, and Rural Development Committee to order for Wednesday, March 26. Let the record note that there is a quorum. We have quite a list of bills that we're going to try to process today as the second deadline approaches. So with that, I would ask that Senator Johnson, with Senate File 2306, please come forward. She's in the door. Can someone grab her?
Thank you.
Senator Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Sparks and committee members. I'm happy to be here. With this, as my husband always says when I say that, it's good to be here. Whenever if someone greets him and says, "It's so good to see you," his response is, "Well, it's a lot better than being viewed." So that's what I feel about being here today. I'm here to bring the unsessioned bill from the Department of Human Rights, and with me is Commissioner Lindsay to tell you about this bill. You can distribute the handout that I presented. I'll point you to that when you get the handout, the one sentence that I'm counting on is, "None of the proposed language will result in a substantive change to Minnesota law." So with that, I would ask the commissioner to talk to you about the bill a little bit and help answer your questions.
Perfect. Thank you. Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senator Johnson is correct. In looking at the governor's priorities as relates to the unsession to streamline respective language and eliminate potential redundancies, we did take a look at 363A36 to see if we can combine paragraphs A into B and just to make it into one paragraph. We have done that, and it does not change any substantive law. We also took a look at Minnesota Subdivision 363A37 with the same kind of I to see if we could eliminate some of that language, and we saw some sentence words that we could eliminate, which we did. And then we also went to Minnesota Statute 473, which talks about the Metropolitan Council and other metropolitan agencies and their obligations to seek and obtain a workforce certificate. So, again, we streamlined the language within that statute. There are no substantive changes as relates to law to those three edits that we have made, or proposed edits we have made.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions from the committee? If not, Senator Eakin moves that Senate File 2306 be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you very much, Senator Johnson.
Senator Sparks, is this going to the floor or?
That is my understanding, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Is Senator Dibble in the room? Okay. All right. Next up, Senator Dibble, Senate File 2819.
So it would be Dibbles. Be the green gem. So.
If he's not here, I'll go.
Committee, I think while we're waiting for Senator Dibble to get here, we'll go ahead and do Senator Sparks' bill, Senate File 2222.
Okay, Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And Senator Dibble must be tied up. So I think that to keep things moving along here, we would like to present Senate File 2222, which is a biodiesel bill. And members, I would like to offer the A1 delete everything author's amendment at this time.
While the amendment's being passed out, do you want to go through that, Senator? Excuse me, Senator Dibble, I think, or Senator Sparks, I think we'll go ahead and adopt it before
okay.
we go through it.
Brian.
The amendment's being passed out. All those who signify of the author's amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The amendment carries. Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The language in front of you represents a compromise worked out with many of the stakeholders. Jerry Schoenfeld from the Minnesota Biodiesel Council is here with me to run through the provisions and answer any questions the committee might have.
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Mr. Chairman, committee members. First of all, biodiesel has been around ahead of this body for a number of years, starting in about 2000. And for all those years, I think this is the fourth time that we've had discussion about this issue. One of the reasons that it's before you today is that in 2008, there was a bill passed by the Minnesota legislature that set up a framework in which there would be progression of higher biodiesel levels in Minnesota's fuel. And the first framework was that the 10% level was to start in 2012. But because of a couple of provisions that were in the law that were part of the to make certain that the 10% biodiesel would work well, it was delayed 2 years before those parts of the law were approved. So this past summer, in 2013, there was a approval by the Departments of Pollution Control, Department of Agriculture, and Department of Commerce to move forward with this, and they've published a 270-day prior notice, and it would take place this summer in July. Now, throughout this legislative session, there have been a number of opponents to moving forward with the B10. And at the same time, we have been trying to listen, and over the years, we've been trying to work with people. Matter of fact, the existing law was a compromise that was put together in 2008, and most of the provisions in the existing law were parts of a compromise and things that a lot of the opposition asked for at that time. Presently, within the amendment, this does not represent a compromise with everybody associated with it. There are still people that do not want to move forward with the B10, but it does bring into a positive arena, I guess, a number of the people who had originally opposed moving forward. So the first thing in it is that because of the delayed implementation for the first 2 years, that there was a two-year delayed implementation beyond the 2012 date that was in the 2008 law, it doesn't. We agree that it doesn't make much sense to move forward with right from B10 to B20 a month later, and basically that the date that was set for the B20 was at May 1st of 2015, and so the first provision in the delete all amendment is to delay that until 2018 to set it out 3 more years. The second thing is that there was a concern by a number of people that this was originally set up as a summer months only situation. Governor Pawlenty, when he originally proposed going to higher blends levels of biodiesel, had proposed to doing that immediately back in 2008, and he had also talked about doing it year-round. In the people I represent, we did not think that was the right thing to do, and so we had negotiated in 2008 to make it a summer-only situation, and that was something that a lot of our opposition had requested at the time, and they were concerned about cold flow issues. Some of those issues are still being concerned. We think we've solved most of those issues, and the fact that in 2008 we brought in a new ASTM standard that tightened up the fuel, took away the glycerin, and diminished those kinds of issues for many, many people. And so at this time, the second provision in this amendment, though, would tighten it up even further, and it would get rid of October. as one of the months in which you would go to the higher blend. The concern there was that in October, someone might buy, even though October is generally a warm month to some degree, that people might put B10 in and then not actually use it until January or something. And so the idea was to give more time to not have that happen. The next thing that is in the amendment is the fact that there were several exemptions that took place originally in the exemptions that took place in the bill, and those exemptions had a sunset date. And so what we've agreed to do is eliminate that sunset date, and therefore these exemptions would become permanent. And the exemptions that are listed in the law are for a number of reasons. First of all, there's one that deals with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, nuclear power plants, and quite frankly, we don't want to be blamed for anything in a nuclear power plant going wrong, so it exempts nuclear power plants. Secondly, railroad locomotives. Most of you know that Amtrak goes from Chicago to Seattle every day, and they can purchase fuel any place along the way. We do know a lot. There are a number of railroads that have used biodiesel, but they wanted to be exempted, and we're not opposing that. Off-road taconite and copper mining equipment, we had hoped at one point that we might be able to do the testing necessary to approve the super large vehicles that exist in the mining in northern Minnesota, but that has not been done, and so we're agreeing to exempt that further as well. And also with regard to off-road logging equipment and machinery, there is a concern there, particularly when tanks are taken out into the woods 30 below zero in the wintertime, and we understand that the fuel distribution system there sometimes can be part of the problem, but we agree that we think that that biodiesel works in engines, but it's still sometimes the distribution system that is a problem, and so we agree with that as well. Vessels of the United States Coast Guard, this has nothing to do with engines as such. What it does have to do with is the fact that when a Coast Guard vessel or the large ships that come across the ocean and the Great Lakes, when they use up their fuel, they actually replace it with water in those tanks in order to perform ballast so that the tanks don't tip over, or so that the ships don't tip over. And so when they go to separate the fuel from the water, they use a centrifuge system. And biodiesel centrifuges differently than regular diesel fuel, so we agree that, and it's also something that's on the asked for by the federal government. Beyond that, there is also an exemption here for the fact that there is a, and this bill started out initially as Senator Sharon's bill, before it's been amended here, and it was for generators tested and validated by an entity that designs and manufactures the generators for use in jurisdictions where biodiesel use is not required. And what that is about is that down in Mankato, Minnesota, the old Cato Light Corporation designs generators for other nations that don't have biodiesel. And so what this is about is a testing. It's about 100,000 gallons that they're interested in having separated out for testing in situations in which they're testing performance for nations that don't have biodiesel, and that's what this is about. It doesn't exempt generators from using biodiesel in general. It's for the testing purposes, for performance and the amount of power that they get out of them. And the last is that there was a provision that stated that the minimum content requirements do not apply for number one diesel fuel. Number one diesel fuel is a low aromatic fuel, and because of that, does not operate quite the same way in terms of its blending properties with biodiesel as number two diesel fuel does. And so because of that, we did previously exempt number one diesel fuel, but it had been exempted for 6 months of the year, and it's generally not used in the summertime. It's generally too expensive to be used in the summertime, and it is usually used in the wintertime to blend down regular diesel fuel in order to make it more more workable in the winter climate. And so because of that, one of the problems is that it used to be that you used to be able to get number one diesel fuel pretty much throughout the state in terms of their terminals. But at the present time, it's down to two or three terminals that supply number one diesel fuel. So we've worked with the petroleum marketers and with Flint Hills to discuss this, and we agree that they need to stockpile this fuel in the summertime. And so because of that, that change is there as well. And then in addition to that, the number one diesel fuel is exempted until the year 2020. There is presently a lot of work being done on a new biodiesel that would deal with winter, that would perform better along with number one diesel fuel, but it is not yet through ASTM standards and so forth, and so it's not ready for prime time. And so we would exempt it until 2020 in order to make sure that that would be properly done. Mr. Chairman, I don't know how much more you would like to discuss. I think you're short on time today, and so I'm going to stop there.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenfeldt. Senator Sparks, do you have any further testifiers?
No, that's it, Mr. Chair.
Members, any questions for Senator Sparks or Mr. Schoenfeldt? Senator Bonhoff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had heard some concerns with regard to this bill, the first version, and so I don't yet know if this addresses those concerns, but one of the concerns was on behalf of a company in my area who had already invested a great deal to comply with the law requiring the biodiesel, the mandate. And so then, you know, there's that investment and then concern around if we make a change. You know, there's something about, you know, business can accept when we do things, but the predictability is important. And so when we make a change, it has unintended consequences. So do you have any comments about that?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not quite certain what company you're speaking about or what their specific situation was, but I can tell you that the initial the bill that was heard in the Commerce Committee and defeated would have eliminated the B10 and the B20 from going into effect at the present time. The B10 going into effect at the present time, it would have eliminated the B20 altogether as it stood. What this bill does is it delays the B20, but it does allow the B10 to go in effect. So if the concern of the company was that they had spent money in order to be ready for the B10, then they would like what we're doing here, I would guess.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson, did you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if Mr. Schoenfeldt can talk a little bit about the exemption for railroad locomotives. And why was that again? Why do we have an exemption for railroad locomotives?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, sometimes when you get involved in these situations, there are two things that you look at. One is practicality and sometimes politics. At the time that this was originally passed, the railroads were very concerned about their locomotives not being able to use biodiesel. And so in 2000, there was a permanent exemption that existed for all of these exemptions that were originally there, including locomotives. The railroads, I think, felt that in 2008, when Representative Junkie carried this bill forward in the 2008 session, that they felt that they should have been able to maintain that permanent exemption, and it was Representative Junkie who was pushing to not do that at the time, and so he put a sunset on it. We recognize that they had their concerns about that. There has been a lot of testing done with railroads. They do their locomotive engineers, as I understand it, I have a letter that says that they approve B5 but not above, and so it was, I guess, a practicality of the sense that if they didn't really want to use it, they probably can just pick it up in South Dakota. So, I mean, there's a practicality that they cross our state every day, and also just listening to their concerns and trying to be somewhat accommodating in terms of how we dealt with this as a compromise.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson,
thank you, Mr.
Up.
Chair. Yes, that kind of gets to my question, not so much about the locomotives, but the fact that they're exempt, because the practicality is they're traversing our nation and they can just fill up anywhere. I don't know if you fill up a locomotive, but however they get refueled. So the question is, one of the things that I'd heard from truckers in my district, bigger trucking firms, is kind of to along that same line, that their drivers now don't fill up in Minnesota. They fill up before they cross the Minnesota border. And we're losing, you know, I think it's $100,000 a month just in this one trucking firm not filling up in Minnesota. So my question is, just wondering if we need a broader exemption with the same language and the same rationale that applies to railroad locomotives, because they can fill up anywhere, might need to apply to our cross-national, our interstate trucking as well.
Well, Madam Chairman, I'm a little puzzled by that because I've heard these kinds of comments as well, and I'm sure that there are some people, for whatever reasons, may take that position. However, in looking at I've talked to the truckers, and they are not totally satisfied because they in 2008 had agreed to the bill that was passed in 2008 that set this in place. As a matter of fact, they were at the signing for the presentation of the bill before the governor. And one of the things that they were concerned about was the pricing situation. And it's very difficult to determine what, and I think that is primarily their concern, is the pricing situation at the present time. I can share with you, if you'd like, I've got the original, in this pile, I've got the original pricing mechanisms that have come out of the terminals in terms of what they're charging for things. But as an example, I went back to May 29th, 2013. At that time, ultra-low sulfur diesel was $3.0589. B5, and this is at the Pine Bend terminal, B5 was $3.0543. So it was actually cheaper. If you look at June, it was actually cheaper by almost three cents a gallon. In July, it was cheaper by 4 cents a gallon. In August, it was cheaper by about 3 cents a gallon, and so forth. And I've also got for St. Paul Park, which shows ULSD at 303 on 529, B5 was at 302.53, and 10% biodiesel was 302.53. The point is that, and I'll share any of this with you, I can give this to you, that if you look month by month here, now there are three factors that are involved in the price situation for biodiesel. One is what comes out of the plant itself in terms of what they're charging for biodiesel, and that's dependent upon feedstocks. And there are many different feedstocks, some of them cheaper than others, in order to provide a different price on biodiesel depending upon what it's made out of. Recently, REG, and we have one of the people from REG here, just spent $55 million down on Albert Lea in order to provide a multi-feedstock facility that would be able to provide biodiesel at the cheapest price possible by using the cheapest feedstock available at the time and still meeting the ASTM standards. They put $55 million into upgrading their plant in order to do so. The second thing that is involved in the biodiesel pricing is something called RINs. It's the Renewable Identification Number. And we probably don't have enough time to get into all of that, but it's basically something that's regulated by the Internal Revenue Service and the EPA, and it basically is a, on the one hand, for obligated parties, they're required to meet so many RINs under the national RFS2 law. And so what that means, it operates differently for terminals in some case, or in other words, it operates differently perhaps for Flint Hills than it operates for somebody that's blending the biodiesel more as a jobber would. But the bottom line is that it has the potential to lower price considerably. And the third thing that's involved is any incentives in terms of tax performance. And until December 31st, we had a tax credit of $1 a gallon that existed because of the federal government. Congress doesn't seem to get its work done too well these days, and so it's tied up in the tax extenders right now and has not been renewed. But I can tell you it's been renewed twice in the past beyond the date that it had expired. And we have pretty good confidence that it's going to be renewed again. And when you add those different factors together, and if you'd like, I'll sit down and take some real time to go through all of that. But when you add all of those together, what it has done is, at least in the past year, both when the tax was on and when the tax was off, because the RIN values change because of whether the tax is on or off, ended up in a situation in which, for instance, March 24th, 2014, It changed a little bit more on the other side, but we had Pine Bend ULSD without biodiesel at $3.07.3. With B5 in it, it was $3.08.4. That is about a penny difference there. And in terms of, in some cases, what we find over the last year, that when you went from a B5 to a B10, you actually lowered the price. And there's a lot of variables here, and I guess when we look at fuel prices, you'll find that, you wake up one morning and gas is up 10 cents a gallon. And it's sometimes hard to explain why that would be the case. I have no doubt that somebody at some point will buy whatever they can cheapest. There's also discounts involved with individual trucking firms and so forth, depending upon the volumes they buy and where they buy it from and all those kinds of things. But I think if you look at the total number of gallons that are in, and I have looked at the total number of gallons that are sold in Minnesota compared to neighboring states and so forth, that we've been pretty consistent with biodiesel in place as a mandate or without. In some cases, they've gone down. During the recession, for instance, we lost volumes, but so did neighboring states. In other cases, they went up. And so it's individual. It is true that it's individual reasons for people doing individual decisions. I can't speak to what their decisions are in all cases, but I can tell you that at least in the last year that we've been very competitive price-wise, whether it's been a B5 or a B10. And Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson or Senator Nelson, I'm not sure why you're hearing what you're hearing.
Senator Nelson, follow-up.
Yep, just a quick follow-up. So I understand the cost issue. I appreciate your description of that. And I also want to just state that I really support value-added markets for our agriculture products, so I think that's a good thing. We just have to kind of weigh what the costs are in total. And, Mr. Schoenfeld, the information that I got wasn't so much about costs, but the trucking firm operators that came to speak to me were concerned something more about, I guess, the problems of using B5 or B10. They're probably not using that yet, but something about filters, and they had to do more maintenance or more changing or something. And so I won't necessarily pursue that avenue right now, but I do think I'd like to work with Senator Sparks and maybe Mr. Fuller at a later time to see if we need exemptions, if maybe we need to exempt those interstate truckers for the same reason that the railroad locomotives are exempted. In other words, they travel across the nation and they can fill up before they hit the Minnesota border. And that's what I'm afraid is happening with a lot of our trucking firms. And quite frankly, I'd rather have them fill up in Minnesota and get that gas tax money here and support our Minnesota businesses instead of the ones in South Dakota or Missouri or Iowa, wherever they're coming from. So I'd like to work with the author on perhaps trying to address that concern, but I'll leave that until we're not in committee here. We'll work on that later. Thank you.
Questions from other members? Hearing none, Senator Sparks moves Senate File 2222 as amended to be passed and referred to the Committee on Environment and Energy. Any further discussion? There being no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Senator Sparks, do you want to do Senate File 2618 next?
Since we're here, maybe that would make sense, Mr. Chair, and then Senator Dibble, I think, should be ready to go after that. But if we could take Senate File 2618 off the table, Mr. Chair.
We need a motion to take that off the table. We will take Senate File 2618 from the table. Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is the Department of Ag's housekeeping bill that we discussed on Monday this week in this committee. I do have an A1 amendment, which I'd like to offer at this time. This is a fix the department brought to us earlier in the week, but it was too late to fix for the Monday's meeting. And if you remember, too, I think Senator Weber had a motion to delete Article 2. And that took place at this time. But this is an amendment that they would like to have offered to their bill. And Santo Cruz is here to explain the amendment, if you'd like to have that happen, Mr. Chair.
Senator Sparks moves the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment carries. Senator Sparks.
For the record, Santo Cruz, MDA. These additional really delete amendments came out of the legislative auditor's report. Due to time constraints of today's hearing, I'll go very quickly through the two provisions. The first, Section 3, is eliminating a private processor of potatoes for a membership in the Potato Council. This is somewhat archaic. There may not be a lot of awareness of the Potato Council in this room at this point, but at any rate, there is no wash plant in that district. So this is in the spirit of the uncession, taking away something that could not, even in theory or in practicality, be applied to this council. So because that cannot be satisfied, we're asking that it be deleted. Also, there's somewhat of a longer story with 17.63 refund of fees. The producers of the canola council back in the 90s, when they were first getting going, had received a letter, which I have seen, from the legislature saying that they had permission to become have a refund of fees provision in the law. And they went ahead and they did that. And when the Office of the Legislative Auditor did the investigation of that, they found that that actually never made it into the law. And so they had been operating as though that had made it into the statute this entire time, and it was merely a clerical error. And so we're asking that that be put in for purposes of uniformity and on the recommendation of the legislative auditor. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Sparks, any further testimony?
Mr. Chair, and maybe not on that, if there's no questions, and maybe Mr. Knopf could help me too, but I would like to amend the language of Senate File 2222 into Senate File 2618. That was the biodiesel language we just adopted, Mr. Chair. We have talked with the department and the governor's office, and they are in agreement with this addition.
Senator Sparks, before we do that amendment, can we finish up the if there's any questions and stuff on your your original bill 2618?
Definitely.
Members, any questions on bill 26?
Yes.
Any questions on bill 20 Senate file 2618? There being no questions, Senator Sparks has moved to. Yes, Senator Sparks moves to amend language on Senate File 2222 onto Senate File 2618. Any discussions?
Mr. Chair, that would be as amended by the committee. So it's the language of Senate File 2222 as amended and sent to the Committee on Energy and Environment and Energy would be adopted as an amendment to Senate File 2618.
Any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Nay. Motion carries. Senator Sparks moves that Senate File 2618, as amended, be recommended to pass. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Senate File 2618 is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Dibble, Senate File 2819.
Brian Brashaw.
Senator Dibble, sorry for that. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's quite all right. I'm avoiding a contentious issue in my own committee right now.
Then, stay as long as you'd like.
That's a reprieve. Yeah. So, Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 2819 is a green jobs deconstruction program proposal. It would propose to create a one-time appropriation to jumpstart a new industry in Minnesota, deconstructing residential buildings, reclaiming materials. So deconstruction, as the name probably implies, is what we would do in lieu of simply demolishing buildings. And, of course, that's gaining quite a bit of momentum nationwide. It's not a brand new idea, but it is picking up pace and gaining quite a bit more attention. What this proposal would do would create a collaborative public-private model to establish deconstruction as a viable alternative in Minnesota. And, of course, that would have substantial environmental, social, and economic benefits. With the pilot, what we hope to do is create great entry-level jobs, great starting point for the chronically unemployed. We know, of course, from the recent studies and all the examination we've done, we talk a lot about the impact on climate from our energy sector, but there's quite a bit from the waste that we landfill and our reliance on landfills, and this would help us avoid quite a bit of that. It would establish a marketplace for selling reusable materials. I think there are some interesting facts. I can pull them out of my little fact sheet here. The second largest component of our nation's waste stream behind municipal solid waste is construction and demolition debris. In a typical 2,000-square-foot wood frame home, we can yield 6,000 board feet of reusable lumber, which would be equivalent to 33 mature trees or the yearly output of 10 acres of planted pine. Many other savings in lots of other arenas as well if we're simply reusing the materials from existing buildings. We have a few folks, with your indulgence, Mr. Chair. They're under strict orders to keep their comments very, very brief, but they can share a little bit more about why they think this is a good idea. We have someone from Better Futures Minnesota, the Northwest Indian OIC in Bemidji, and the Natural Resources Research Institute at the University of Minnesota, Duluth. So with that, I'll let them decide who gets
sure.
to go first.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve Thomas, President and CEO of Better Futures Minnesota. As the Senator just mentioned, building deconstruction is a growing movement nationwide, and it's an underdeveloped practice here in the state. So this one-time startup funding would enable us and our partner, the Northwest area, or Northwest OIC up in Bemidji, to fully develop this practice into a sustainable business enterprise. We, employment's a centerpiece of our social enterprise. We employ about 90 different at-risk men a year. We estimate that this investment would enable us just in the Twin Cities to train and employ about 40 different men a year. And as the Senator mentioned, this kind of work is easy entry, but it provides pathways to more skilled labor with the trades and in the construction industry. And then lastly, there's three, along with the environmental benefits, which are significant, there's three revenue sources that enables us to sustain this endeavor. One, we get paid for the work. Two, we're able to sell the materials that we harvest from the house. And then three, as will be mentioned in a moment, there's a ton of material that can be reclaimed and repurposed into many other things, from furniture to fire starters to flooring. With that, I'd like just to turn it over to my colleague, Talia Palmer from the Northwest OIC.
Thank you. Ms. Palmer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Talia Palmer. I'm the director of Northwest Indian OIC. We're located in Bemidji, Minnesota. We serve a 50-mile radius of Bemidji, which includes the Red Lake Nation, the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, and the White Earth Band of Ojibwe. Our program last year served 1,256 individuals with comprehensive culturally specific workforce development skills. We're really interested in this program in an effort to create jobs that protect the environment and are sustainable. Where we live is home to more than 50% of the American Indian population of Minnesota. The unemployment rates where we live fluctuate between twice the state average and 66% in some portions of Red Lake Nation. The jobs that do exist, one-third of them pay less than $9.95 an hour. So we're very hopeful that we'll be able to start this program. We've been partnering with the Indian housing authorities from all three nations to create a demand market for the product in an effort to create jobs for men returning home from prison.
Thank you, Ms. Palmer. Sir, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Brian Brash. I'm with the University of Minnesota Duluth Natural Resources Research Institute. I'm a research team leader in our small business and business organization development unit. one of the things that we've worked very hard on in the last number of years is working with small businesses to help them develop new products and develop new markets to create revenue and to create jobs. Through that relationship, we became involved with Better Futures Minnesota about 12 months ago, and we've been working with them to identify, through a small seed grant program, innovation program that we have, to identify some potential product options. These buildings that are being deconstructed have high-grade, typically Douglas fir lumber that was used to construct a number of these buildings, urban buildings in the earlier 1900s. So there are a wide range of different kinds of things that can be created, from flooring products to lumber products to paneling, from the solid sawn materials that were pulled out of either the roofing, the framing materials, the stud materials in the walls or the subfloors. Beyond that, there are other materials that have typically gone into landfills that we're looking at. One of the things that is in this jar, actually, is porcelain. And porcelain is one of those things that when buildings are deconstructed, we're talking about sinks and we're talking about toilets. They've historically continued to go into the landfill. So we've, through a simple grinding and processing, developed some opportunity for landscape and landscape materials. One of the other products that typically does come out of a home is recycled appliances. So we've worked with them, Better Futures, to identify some strategic and creative ways to look at it. So a typical compressor that would come out of a refrigerator might be worth about $30 a ton, or this compressor might be worth about 50 cents on the recycling market. By simply cutting the top off and pulling out the copper, we've created about $5 or $6 worth of revenue just by simply reprocessing and repurposing some of these materials. There are other products and applications that are potentially have opportunities that Better Futures have been involved with in other recycling. That includes other parts of appliances, sheet metal, and even things like books that don't have homes anymore, so some creative fire starters. Paper can be recycled in its current form, but the book binding has to come off. So it's a wide range of opportunities that this bill will and can create opportunities to create employment and also reduce landfill obligations for the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brasha. Sounds like you're doing some great work up there.
This is a... But I have to ask, Senator, I don't know, what is this?
That's from Mr. Chair. That's
Mr. Thomas.
This is a dehumidifier. We get tons of these. So we actually are partnering with a school to paint them and then sell them to nurseries, you know, mm-hmm. and could be a little windmill in your garden.
Okay. Thank you.
And you can call soap if you want to buy some, too.
Okay. Mr. Chair, there are a number of folks here from Better Futures. If they could raise their hands, they're here today to...
It's one of our work crews. Yeah.
Okay, good. Thank you for all you do. Thanks. Any questions for Senator Dibble or any of the testifiers? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having been involved when recycling solid waste was getting started in my community, we're always concerned about that, the other end, where you market and that type of thing. As it relates, like, particularly to used lumber, I assume is most of that yet reused in terms of being chipped and then into a composite material, or is there actually some of that intended to be structural lumber again?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator. Bradshaw?
Strictly, there's a number of options. Typically, it's not going to be reused as a structural lumber because we deal with a lot of regrading issues in terms of structural building codes. However, much of this solid sawn lumber can be repurposed into things like this large panel here is flooring or furniture or tabletops or counter applications, a lot of value-added manufacturing, which can create homes and it can also create jobs here. The lower grades, that material that may not be suitable for reconstructing or repurposing, could be chipped and turned into things like biomass energy for District Energy St. Paul, for instance.
One follow-up.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up, at this point in time, are there a considerable number of outlets for the product that you reclaim?
Mr. Thomas?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's one of the challenges, frankly, we've been facing, is especially on the two coasts, there's huge demand for the lumber and for many of the materials pulled out. So part of this pilot is to build those marketplaces. Right now we are selling online. We're doing about $5,000 to $10,000 worth of sales a month. And most of what we're selling is cabinetry, light fixtures, mantles. But we need to build bigger marketplaces, a larger marketplace for a broader range of materials.
Senator Mr. Chair,
okay. I apologize. I guess we did have one other young man who would like to share a few thoughts, okay. If you don't mind.
Mr. Yeah. Chair, I'm Lante Morris. I represent the employees at Better Futures. And the job market that it helps people who like coming in, new entry people, learn new skills like and different things like building deconstruction. A lot of men never had jobs or never knew about taking down a house and things like that. And it really trains you, make sure you get OSHA training and all those things and the necessary steps in order to take down a house. And it's really environmental and helpful for every man that comes into a situation where they can't find employment and things like that. So
good. Thank you very much. So Senator Nelson, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I have an amendment.
Okay.
Are we ready for amendments, or do we have more testifiers?
Absolutely.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In working with deed bills before, particularly as this committee will recall, like in the angel investor tax credits, we realized that we didn't have a good measure about how many of those credits were going to minority and women-owned businesses. And that's something that I think we might want to add on page line 2.19, just to collect that data. I'd like to ask Senator Dibble's thoughts on this. But my amendment would be on line 2.19, strike the first "and," replace it with a comma, and then change the period after participants to a comma and add "and the number of minority and women performing those jobs." I just think that's good information for us to have. That's a concern of many of us to make sure that we are our work dollars, the things that we put into job creation, make sure that we know that those are getting to all segments of our society.
Senator Dibble, your thoughts?
Mr. Chair, that sounds great.
Okay.
It's a great suggestion.
Okay. And does Council have it? You guys have it? Okay. On Senator Nelson's oral amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Nay. The motion prevails. The oral amendment is adopted. Okay. Any further discussion? Senator Deems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble. Most of our counties have environmental offices in them, and there's where you go to get your permit if you're going to deconstruct a building. And I'm wondering why we're not just using an incentive program so if somebody goes in to get a permit to deconstruct a building, I think we could get further in green deconstruction if we were just using that as an incentive. And the environmental office, if you do this, you get this much, and do this, you get this much, and distribute it through our counties versus creating another function here. I just question how efficient this program is going to be. And with that said, we're talking about monitoring activities and outcomes, and I'm wondering what type of measurements are going to be used to determine if we've had successful outcomes and what success is going to be.
Senator Dibble, are your witnesses?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we have some experience with just trying to go county by county. Yes. It's actually, I think, less efficient than
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Thomas.
Senators, first of all, we are working closely in the metro area with both Hennepin and Ramsey, both because they're a source of buildings and because they have been working with us to incentivize, and it has been hard. Frankly, it's cheap to demolish, and the two biggest complaints are deconstruction takes longer and it costs more, and we're trying, part of this pilot is to become competitive and efficient. And one of the major goals of this pilot is to work with the counties and the state to develop model policies that would create incentives for both the private and public sectors to do this kind of work. I believe, if I may address the other question about outcomes, we've tried to be fairly prescriptive about the number of jobs, the environmental impact. In addition, though, a core outcome is, can we make this work financially? The intent of this startup funding is to build this into a sustainable social enterprise, and we support that through the sale of our service and the sale of the materials, either sold directly or reclaimed in new production.
Follow-up.
Senator Deems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, you stated that the outcomes have been measured have not been very successful. Can you tell me what rural counties you're speaking about where these outcomes and this has been measured and what the success rate has been?
Senator Dibble, are your witness?
Yeah, I think my,
Thomas?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm not personally aware of any rural counties, unless Ms. Palmer is aware of what's going on up in her part.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Dibble.
I will put in a plug for the SCORE funding that is in front of the legislature right now, and all the dollars that are being diverted into the general fund. Senator Daines, this might be an opportunity for us to work together to use some of those SCORE funds for their original purpose and get those dollars out into counties' hands for this purpose of diverting a lot of this material from landfills. You know, a lot of the SCORE funding, of course, is very much focused on residential recycling and making grants to cities and the like, but this might be an opportunity for us to use some of those resources, like fully 20-some million dollars per year of funds that are collected taxes on our solid waste charges. Senator Weber is familiar with this issue because he's on the committee where we heard and discussed this. Is diverted to the general fund, which is bad. We should use that money for what it was originally collected, and we can create more success at the county level on this kind of thing.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question didn't get answered, but that's okay. I will just leave it at that.
Okay. Any further discussion on Senate File 2819? This bill does have a few more stops as well. So, seeing none, Senator Bonoff moves that Senate File 2819 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Energy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks.
Senator Dibble, you have Senate File 2727.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Members. Mr. Chair, members, I do have the A3 delete everything amendment.
That's okay.
Yes. I don't know if that's.
Senator Bonoff will move the A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author prefers. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The A3 amendment is adopted. Senator Dibble, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So Senate File 2727 has to do with bees, pollinators. I think this committee has already heard quite a bit about that, so I won't go into the background of how important pollinators are, and we're losing pollinators at an alarming rate, et cetera, et cetera. This bill seeks to get at kind of one narrow issue that is a part of that larger discussion, and that's those instances where colonies are lost due to pesticides that they come into direct contact with from either the willful use of pesticides to destroy that colony, or the use of the pesticides in a manner that isn't consistent with its proper use and handling as the label and as the Commissioner of Agriculture has established for that pesticide. And it determines a way to investigate and then make the owners of those hives whole. So very, very quickly, what this bill does, I'll just walk through it quickly, is it reestablishes some definitions that had been deleted from statute a few years ago when the apiary program itself was eliminated at the Department of Agriculture. It does not reestablish that program, but it picks up those definitions and reestablishes those for the purposes of this proposal. It creates the authority for the Commissioner of Agriculture to take enforcement action for use of pesticides that results in these bee deaths. It establishes an emergency response team that the commissioner can put together to be deployed in the event of a colony that is killed, so that they can very quickly go to the scene, find the bees, get the bees tested quickly before either the material that killed them deteriorates or the bees themselves deteriorate, so that they can assist in the investigation of why those bees died exactly. Then it sets up a procedure for that compensation that's proposed by this bill. It says that the Commissioner of Agriculture must compensate folks for the loss of bees or bee colonies in those instances when the person cannot be determined, or the pesticide was applied, but it was applied in a manner that's consistent with its labeling and handling requirements. And it establishes that compensation is for the value of those bees, no less than $100, and no more than $20,000 in a given year for those claims. It says that an eligible bee owner needs to be registered with a pesticide registry program, and we can have more testimony on what that means exactly. It does require that those who are applying pesticides do apply their pesticides in a manner that's consistent with the labeling requirements. There is someone who, if the bee colony has been lost, if the person is found to be responsible because they have used the pesticide in a manner that's inconsistent with this labeling or has done so in a willful manner, then folks aren't eligible for payment from this restitution fund. That person must bear the costs of the restitution. It sets forth some procedures for how folks can file a claim, how the commissioner can make the determination, what the commissioner's process is in the event that the commissioner denies compensation from the fund, or because, in fact, they're requiring restitution from the individual. It allows for some appeal of that decision in the event of a denial of compensation. And finally, it makes sure that if folks, in fact, are being repaid from some other source. I do know that there is not insurance available for the actual animals. There's insurance available for the equipment that's related to beekeeping. But we did keep in the language that says that if, in fact, someone is being compensated for their bee loss from some other source, they're not able to go to this fund for reimbursement. The entire amount of reimbursement statewide is capped at $150,000 per year. It establishes the Minnesota Zoo as the official pollinator bank for the state of Minnesota. It asks the Commissioner of Agriculture to figure out a way to determine the value of bees, beehives, colonies, apiaries, the queen apiary, for the purposes of establishing these compensation levels. And it appropriates $100,000 from the general fund for the purpose of funding this emergency response team. And I think I failed to mention that there's the $150,000 cap that I referenced a second ago. That comes out of the pesticide regulatory account in which, I guess, a $4 million balance is carried. It's a restitution system that's set up similarly to the wolf depredation restitution system that we have already. It's modeled on that. With that, we have Santo Cruz from the Department of Agriculture, who's here to help me field questions and or respond from the Department of Agriculture's perspective, and I'm able to respond to questions. We have a few folks who are here who themselves experienced this pesticide issue in my district, who can share a couple of thoughts, and we have Marla Spivak from the University of Minnesota, who is a researcher who researched that particular instance and is an expert in this arena as well, and has provided some feedback on this bill.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. I think we did hear from her a couple of days ago. Senator Dietzick had a bill, too. So I don't know, Mr. Cruz, if you want to comment. Otherwise, we'll let members respond.
Mr. Chair, Santa Cruz, Department of Agriculture. I have to make an embarrassing admission. I grew up on a dairy farm running a lot of loud machinery, and if there's background noise, I can hear next to nothing. So I made it through several years of prosecuting quiet courtrooms without making that admission, but you guys got me in the first couple weeks of session to admit that. So I will ask for you to please speak up. I am hard of hearing if there is background noise.
Okay, thank you. Questions, members?
So Mr. Chair, we do have someone who wanted to share a little bit of her experience in my district with, you might have heard about this big incident in Minneapolis where some pesticide was applied inappropriately. Never figured out quite who it was, but we lost literally hundreds of thousands of bees on that particular day.
Okay.
Chris Allen here.
Chris, welcome to the committee. If you could keep your remarks somewhat brief, though, we do have four very important bills that we need to get
sure.
to. So welcome to the committee, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. Last fall, we lost three hives in the Kenwood neighborhood of Minneapolis. Two of the hives were from hobby beekeepers, and one of the hives was from my small business called the Bee's Knees. I was here 2 days ago talking about the pollinator labeling bill, which was wonderful. Thank you for hearing that. And we're here today because this bill is very, very important as small business owners who are trying to make a living taking care of bees, teaching people about bees. We have 12 different host sites in Minneapolis parks, schools, community gardens, and urban farms where we take people into hives and we show them what's going on to connect them to their food system. And because of this pesticide kill on our hive, we went under an investigation with the Department of Ag and with the University of Minnesota. We could determine what the chemical was, but we could not determine who did it, and we were not compensated for the loss of that hive. So the value of that hive was the equipment, the bees, but also what we could have taught in education to Blake School and the honey from those hives.
Thank you very much, Ms. Allen. Members have questions for Senator Dibble or the witnesses? Senator Dames.
I just have a question for Mr. Cruz. Can you tell me how many issues like this are getting reported to the Department of Ag every year? Are we having many incidences like this? How many got reported last year?
Mr. Cruz?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, I believe it was...
For the past how many years?
Past year, I believe it was less than a half dozen.
And this
Senator
only
comes. Go ahead, sir. Yep.
Chair, this only covers pesticide coverage. So, if the bees die from some other diseases or something, that this is not covering that strictly pesticides. Is that correct,
Mr. Chair?
Senator Dibble.
Yes, Senator Dame, that's correct. I can point out in the language where it says that. So it says. It doesn't say it in the negative, but it just says the Commissioner of Agriculture must compensate a person for an acute pesticide poisoning resulting in death of bees or loss of bee colonies owned by a person. So it has no provision for compensating folks, and that's why we have the investigation to determine that, in fact, that the bees died from pesticide poisoning, not from cold, not from fungus or anything like that.
Mr. Cruz?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, you bring up a very good point, and that is that the issue of pollinators and bees in general is a very complex one. There is no magic bullet, and this isn't a piece of legislation that we're supporting because we think it addresses every issue. You're absolutely right. There's things like the varroa mite. There's other problems in the bee world as far as lack of habitat. For those of you who are familiar with the monarch butterfly, there they do know that the milkweed is one of the largest contributors, but there's other, I guess we would say, political or policy reasons surrounded why that habitat is going away. We do not have that situation with pollinators or bees in general. It is a complex landscape that deserves more study, but this is acting on what we know for right now.
Senator Dames.
Just to follow up, I guess one of my concerns is in rural Minnesota, a lot of farmers are spraying a lot of crops, and so if a farmer sprays his crops, he has no way of controlling if those bees are going to come over. So if they if there's a crop that was sprayed and some of that crop has pollinators in it and the bees come over and ingest the pollen off of those and then die, is there going to be some responsibility due to that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, no. If the applicator followed the label, and the label is the law on the pesticide, then no, there wouldn't be any liability to the farmer because they followed the law as best they knew how, and they followed the best management practices. So that would not fall upon the farmer, and that's absolutely what we would like to avoid here.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you very much. Any further questions, members?
And, Mr. Chair, we have someone who would like to share a few brief thoughts.
Very brief. My name's Gary Reuter, and I work with Dr. Spivak at the University of Minnesota, and I represent the bee lab and the commercial beekeepers. Many of our commercial beekeepers, and most of them are in the southern states with their bees right now doing pollination, and so unfortunately they're not up here, but their bees are all here in Minnesota in the summer. So we see this bill as a big step for helping the beekeepers that are dealing with issues in agriculture today. And to our knowledge, Minnesota is the only one that's coming forward to something like this, and I think it's going to be a big step forward for the nation. So the one thing that is brought up is about the beekeepers registering their beehives, and one of their concerns with that is that recently now, because the price of bees has gone up and all like that, there's been a lot of thefts of bees, not as much in Minnesota and other areas, but when they register their bees and they're on properties that don't belong to them, and so they're not right there, and so registering the bees for them can be problematic. So I think this bill, all in all, is a good bill, and thank you for taking it up.
Appreciate your comments. Thank you very much. Any further discussion on Senate File 2727? Seeing none, Senator Schmidt moves that Senate File 2727 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on State and Local Government. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next on the agenda, we have Senator Goodwin. Is she in the room? Senator Goodwin, Senate File 1999. Senator Goodwin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we start, I'd like to have somebody make a motion to adopt the A6 amendment.
So moved, Mr. Chair. Move the A6.
This amendment that puts it more in line with what the House language is.
Okay. Senator Eakin will move the A6 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no. Nay. The motion prevails. The A6 amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The bill is really a pretty simple bill. It just prevents an employer from retaliating or taking action against an employee if they disclose their own wages. It's really First Amendment right issue, and it has happened that some employers do have, a number of them, I guess, do have in their handbooks, they have a requirement that they not disclose their own wages. What this has the effect of doing is preventing wage fairness and between employees that perhaps do the same kind of work or whatever. So I have somebody here that I'd like to tell her story. Her name is Heather Robinson.
Ms. Robinson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Heather Robinson, and I am here today not only to urge you to support this bill, but also to demonstrate the reason the legislation is so important. I was hired at less pay than my male coworkers at a job and later found out. I was humiliated but had signed a contract that prohibited conversations with fellow employees about wages. I would have had to have had a conversation with one of the fellow employees to have brought this up to HR, which made it difficult for me to make any sort of complaint pertaining to the matter. And if I should have made a complaint, it would have gotten one of my coworkers in trouble as well, which made the situation very awkward. That I had been required to sign this form as a condition of employment tied my hands pertaining to any meaningful action besides looking for another job. But even if I had not been asked to sign this form per my employer's requirement, I could never have afforded the legal counsel or representation necessary. Thus, as much as there has been much discussion about employers' bottom lines, I am concerned that it has not been made clear that employees might also be at a strong disadvantage. The burden is actually on the employee to seek legal counsel or representation. As a single parent, legal counsel has never been an option for me, and I simply could never afford it. In a separate incident at a separate job, I had been hired at an hourly wage of $12 plus commission. I received an annual wage increase of $1 per year, although the manager decreased the commission schedule payout. I was able to perform highly based on my experience and expertise. After 3 years and three substantial pay increases, as the business grew, I suggested that another employee be hired part-time to meet the business's growing demands. I had over 10 years of experience in my field when I was hired. The company then hired a male employee at the same rate of pay with no previous experience. In fact, he hadn't even worked for several years previous to being hired, so he was unemployed. And he had worked in a completely separate industry prior to being hired. I was responsible for training him in, and I only learned about his rate of pay after he complained to me about it during the training process. I felt humiliated and exasperated in both cases. I lost trust for my employer. I felt taken advantage of. I didn't feel like the hard work I had performed, my skills, my expertise, or my loyalty to the company mattered to my employer. Subsequently, I suffered from anxiety and depression. There are real-life consequences with the issue of pay inequality. My only recourse was to quit. When the only recourse is quitting, it causes both the employer and the employee financial hardship. I urge you to support this bill so that other women do not have to suffer the humiliation and injustice of pay inequality. I urge you to support this bill so that women can achieve economic security. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Robinson, for sharing your story. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there somebody, Senator Goodwin, who is with you who could tell me the existing rights under the National Labor Relations Act with regard to what's currently federal law protecting employee disclosure or discussion of wages?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, this is Lisa Stratton.
Ms. Stratton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me, Mr. Chair and committee members. And I didn't prepare for the bar exam to come today, so I can give you a general sense. And it is decided, of course, on a case-by-case basis, and case law differs in different jurisdictions. But generally speaking, the NLRA would cover employees who speak to each other about collective bargaining. Wages are usually considered a core topic, so people who fell under the act arguably could be protected, but a number of loopholes have been identified that make that coverage insufficient and this coverage of this act necessary. And those include the fact that supervisors are not covered under the National Labor Relations Act, and supervisor is really quite broadly defined in that context. And so Lilly Ledbetter, for example, would not have been covered by the National Labor Relations Act. She was unable to find out her coworker's pay until she got an anonymous note from her coworker, and so she wouldn't have had coverage protected for talking about her wage with him.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Goodwin, I understand the impetus for the bill is with regard to, what strategies can we employ as policymakers to close that gap, the gender pay gap. And so that's the bill is addressing that. The concern I have with this bill is after, spending 20 years in business, I don't ever recall a time where it was appropriate to discuss wages in a company. It's pretty much like the sort of unspoken rule you don't do that because it creates a lot of ill will between people, and it's kind of the rumor mill that everybody knows you're not supposed to talk about, having nothing to do with gender, just the natural human tendencies that get pretty nasty when people start comparing their wages to each other. So I just wonder if you have any thoughts about that or comments about that.
I do, Mr. Chair and Senator Bonner. First of all, nothing in this bill is going to force them to tell their salaries. And in fact, it says that right in it. Secondly, if you and I are friends and we work for the same company, we go out for a drink after work and we start talking about our salaries, and then I go back and say, gee, you know, Terry's getting $10 an hour more than I am. Look, I could fire us both. And so, yeah, you're right. You know, salaries and politics and sex are things you don't talk about for the most part. But when somebody does, they ought not be fired for it. And that's what this bill is doing.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin. On your amendment here, number three, there shouldn't be any issues if they talk about somebody else's wages that were disclosed voluntarily. So you and your friend go out for a drink, and your friend knows that you like the gossip. So they decide to tell you they're getting $20 an hour, and you're only getting $10. So then you go back to work the next day, and you start telling people that so-and-so is getting $20 an hour. Now, the employer has nothing he can do about that, but listen to this rumor mill go around, and pretty soon everybody gets stirred up because people know that you, and I'm not specifically saying you, but people know that this person that we're trying to protect, they like to stir the pot. So somebody tells them they're getting $20 an hour when they're only getting $10, and you start spreading that rumor, what is your employer supposed to do? Is that's according to this, that's fine.
Because Mr. Chair,
that person voluntarily gave you that information. Sorry. It doesn't say it has to be correct.
Well, Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, the employer certainly could tell people that that was untrue, that person is not making that amount. And rumors can happen now any way that you want them to in a place of business. You can say, you know, somebody's making, if you use that example, you could do that now. And I don't know how you can prevent rumors in any business for any reason, but this, at least the person that is accurately describing it is, accurately describing what somebody else told them, they still should get fired for it.
Senator Dan.
Follow up, Mr. Chair and Senator. You know, I don't necessarily have a problem if you want to disclose your salary, but I do have a problem if you're going to disclose other people's salary when you truly don't know what it is because you were talking in a bar. You know, I just think that's unfortunate that we're going to pass legislation that allows people to do that. I just don't think we need to do that.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
I think it's quite unfortunate that employers would say that they would take away your First Amendment rights and put it in their handbooks that you can't tell your wages to anybody and that they can fire you for doing so. That, to me, is unfair.
Senator Schmidt?
So, Mr. Chair, I've had an opportunity to speak with the author regarding this bill and also a number of our committee members here prior to committee today. And I know that there are some concerns with aspects of the bill, and I'd like to try to address them and keep this bill moving forward. And I would like to offer to the committee, just to get in front of everybody, the A3 amendment and get that to the author as quick as possible. And I think it goes it tries to address some of the concerns that we're discussing right here with regards to sharing of wage information. And so once everybody has it in front of them, we're adding to this, number four towards the bottom. And what it specifies is that nothing in this subdivision shall be construed to permit the employee to disclose wage information to a competitor of their employer. And I think that might help address some of these concerns with the sharing of wage information. I would like to offer, an oral amendment to this amendment, if we could, and perhaps we should consider that right away here.
Senator Schmidt.
In speaking with the author, I think language that might be a little bit more acceptable is, under four towards the bottom, permit the employee to disclose wage information of other employees to a competitor of their employer. So what it means is that nothing within this subdivision could be construed as such, and an individual employee could talk about what he or she is compensated to another employer, but he or she could not share information that that is gathered from the current employer and share that with a competitor, for instance. I think that addresses some of the concerns folks may have over that aspect of this. And then I also heard of another concern, and that's regarding the effective date of this and just giving human resources departments an opportunity to kind of react to what's passed. And perhaps rather than having this section be effective the day following final enactment, giving them 90 days to do so. And Senator, that just came to my attention. I hope you would take that as a friendly change here. With that said, I would hope to offer that oral amendment to change currently line 1.20 and also 1.22 as discussed.
I think, Senator Schmidt, let's have a little discussion, and then before we move the bill, we'll just incorporate your oral amendments into the A3 amendment. Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chair, just a technical thing. On the effective date, you've got the day following final enactment here. If it's unspecified, it'd be August 1st.
Okay.
So if you just delete that line from your amendment, it would just make it August 1st. Unless this becomes part of the appropriation bill, then it could be July 1st. But sure. it would give some time.
Sure. I think that's what we're shooting for, some time. I'm happy to do that. Delete. August 1st is fine.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
So we delete line 122.
Senator Goodwin.
All right. I will accept those two amendments, to the amendment. But what I want to keep is this. If you notice, this section now applies to 181 under this amendment, and I want it to apply to 363A, which is a human rights amendment. So I would accept this amendment as is with his two changes if it applies to the same chapter that we had it applying to now.
That's another significant aspect of this amendment. Sorry, I didn't mean to gloss over that. In speaking with some of our committee members, I know that might be a concern in and of itself, and I guess I would welcome some additional discussion on that aspect of this. And again, I'd like to offer this amendment as it in its current form. And I think we should spend a little bit of time talking about the section that's referenced. To your point, Senator Goodwin. And perhaps there's some comment, some testimony to that point.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Melissa Rafan, and I am a partner with the law firm of Dorsey & Whitney, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Employment Law Council, MALC, which is a group of the state's largest employers. With respect to the amendment just proposed, the A3 amendment, we believe that the proposed changes are in keeping with the spirit of the and objective of the purpose of the act in the first place. And we think it's appropriate that it be placed in Chapter 181 because it is consistent with the other laws that are in Chapter 181. This is not a protected class, so it does not belong under 363A.08 under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. We're not creating a protected class of people. We are simply creating a prohibition on what employers can do. I would also propose that in B3, where it talks about diminish any existing rights under the National Labor Relations Act, under USC Title 29, that a period be put there, because we have been told by the advocates that there are no other laws protecting the disclosure of wages. Therefore, we shouldn't be referencing other provisions of state or federal law because we've been told there are no other laws. So rather than have it be confusing, I think we need to be more specific. And in terms of just the points that were made earlier, just so the committee is aware, perhaps if it's not, employees obtain counsel to represent them in these cases on contingent fee. So the idea that there's a burden on employees is offset by the fee arrangement that plaintiffs' employers use to handle these cases. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rafan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I just want to briefly state we support what the Minnesota Employment Law Council said. I think we were really concerned about putting this in 363A. This applies to all workers. It doesn't apply specifically to protected classes. I think it's important just from a technical issue as well. When we discussed earlier, the National Labor Relations Act already covers non-supervisory employers from discussing their wages with each other, and that's under a labor policy. I think this belongs under 181, which oversees our labor policies in the state, and not under 363A. So I appreciate the committee's time and stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gerber.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
I would like to have our Commissioner of Human Rights speak on why it's in this chapter.
Commissioner Lindsay.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think as drafted, actually, it does belong within the Minnesota Human Rights Act. If you take a look at Minnesota Statute 36308, it talks about wages, terms, conditions of employment. And this goes really to the heart of that provision within the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Because we deal with, again, across all protected classes, concerns that individuals have about underpayment of wages, so it would belong. I also think it's important to make sure that we're all talking about the same thing. The testimony that you just heard talked about classifying this as a protected class. This would not create a new protected class under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. That provision in the Minnesota Human Rights Act is 36302. And that goes, generally speaking, race, age, creed, religion, and there's a whole host of others. You're not amending the Minnesota Human Rights Act to create a new protected class. You're putting what already exists, the ability to bring claims against your employer for violation of underpayment of wages, and that exists within 36308. As relates to the question concerning the National Labor Relations Act, there is an important distinction because you are talking about a greater class of employees which would now be protected under the law.
Which greater class?
Thank you, Commissioner.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
I can also say that I would accept the change to number three on here that was suggested here, putting a period after Title 29 and eliminating the rest of that sentence.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could,
Senator Schmidt,
if I could further amend my oral amendment to the amendment, and in line 118, anything after Title 29, place a period and delete, and then delete all of line 1.19.
Okay. And then, can you just repeat for members and Mr. Fuller? I believe he stepped out on line 1.20. What you were inserting?
So the oral amendment to the amendment is as just discussed with lines 118 and 119, and then on line 120, after information, we insert of other employees.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And then we'd also strike, if I'm not mistaken, line 122.
Okay, thank you.
And the default would be August 1st.
Okay, further discussion.
Mr. Chair, may I make one other point in response to
Mr.
what—
Mr. Fan.
I apologize. Mr. Chair, in response to what Commissioner Lindsay said, I just want to clarify my earlier comment. By placing this in the Minnesota Human Rights Act, we are essentially creating a new protected class. In other words, all individuals who have any adverse action taken against them because they disclose pay now become an additional protected class under the Human Rights Act. And if you look at Chapter 181 and the other laws that are captured under 181, this is consistent. This is not an Equal Pay Act. This is consistent with the other laws under Chapter 181, and I think it appropriately fits there. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. Okay. Further questions from members?
Mr. Chair, if I could just say I see great value in what's being addressed here, and just in speaking with my colleagues here today, I really want to see this continue forward. So I hope the amendment is taken in that vein, and I guess I would renew the amendment that's before us.
Okay. Senator Schmidt moves the A3 amendment. We'll incorporate his oral amendments into that. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The A3 amendment is adopted. Thank you very much. Seeing no further discussion, Senator Schmidt moves that Senate File 1999 as amended be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Goodwin. Next we have Senator Wicklund, Senate File 2006.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Goodwin. Senator Wicklund, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Sparks. Glad to be here. I'm presenting Senate File 2006, and let me get my notes out. And what I'd like to do, I've reached agreement with a lot of parties to bring an amendment forward, and I'd like to make sure that you all have the amendment, and I can delete all amendments, so I should probably go through that first, and then I can
Senator
talk
Wicklund,
about
let's go ahead. I know that you've worked hard on this, and I think that it's coming around, and members will get it, so we can go ahead and adopt it, and then we can discuss your amendment, if that's okay with you.
That's fine, too.
Senator Bonhoff will move the...
Yeah.
The SCS 2006-3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The the 063 amendment is adopted. Senator Wicklund, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Sparks. And I'd just like to go through the bill. It's a bill relating to caregivers and employee sick leave benefits. Paragraph A, it relates to which type of categories that can use I'll start over again. It adds another category to the ones listed, which allow employees to use personal sick leave to take care of siblings, parents, and so on. It adds grandchild to that list. This is to expand and add another category that many caregivers need to take care of their grandchildren. Paragraph B, this is a safety leave paragraph, and it relates to using sick leave for the purpose to assist an employee when they have some event or crisis in their lives having to do with sexual assault, domestic abuse, or stalking. It also applies to employees or relatives who might be in the situation, and it allows them to use their earned sick leave to take care of services or legal system protections that might come up due to these events. It defines what domestic abuse means, defines what sexual assault means and stalking, and shows where they appear in statute so that people know what qualifies. Paragraph C just adds the safety leave and grandchild to the paragraph that defines what the minimum earned sick leave hours are. Then on page 2, the other remaining changes, for the purpose of this section, it defines what a grandchild includes: step-grandchild, biological, adopted, and foster grandchildren. And the last statement, it has to do with retaliation, and will state that employers shall not retaliate against employees for requesting or obtaining a leave of absence under this section, so protection against retaliation. This bill, in this form now with the delete all amendment, will provide additional support for caregivers, which is essential given the growing need for workers to balance paid work responsibilities with unpaid caregiving. According to the Minnesota Board on Aging, nearly two-thirds of Minnesota's caregivers are employed either full or part-time, so this is a big concern. Unpaid elder care has a significant impact on the economy. One estimate by AARP is that the national value of unpaid contributions to care for adult relatives with chronic conditions or disabilities was approximately $450 billion in 2009. That amount is more than the total Medicaid spending, which was $361 billion in that same year. So this really has a large impact on our economy, even though it's not something you can tally in a business within a business itself. Allowing workers additional flexibility with their use of their earned sick leave will assist in allowing that unpaid care to continue and allow for greater job security, which is important. In terms of the safe leave, I'll just make a couple points about that, but I do have a testifier here who will speak to that. Access to services and the legal system are really a key part of improving the lives of victims of domestic and sexual violence. People shouldn't have to make a choice between losing their hours or a paycheck or a job in order to avail themselves of legal system protections or counseling services. So this bill would go some distance towards fixing this problem by ensuring workers can use their sick leave to address legal concerns or other services. And I do have a testifier here. Is it Caroline Palmer? To speak to the safe leave aspect of the bill.
Good. Thank you, Senator Wicklund. Ms. Palmer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members, and thank you to Senator Wicklund. I'm pleased to be here to speak in support of this bill. What I'd like to do is to just paint a picture for you of what might happen in the first few days after a sexual assault or domestic abuse. These are all the issues that somebody may need to deal with. They may need to deal with medical care. They might have to go to the hospital for themselves or somebody in their family. They have to figure out where they go. Maybe their home is no longer safe. Where will they live? Child care, where will their child be taken care of while they're dealing with all of these issues? And what will happen to the child at their school when they are maybe at risk from being harmed? What kind of legal needs will they need? Will they have to go get a protective order? Will they have to be going to criminal court? What about their housing? Do they have to break a lease? Do they have to move immediately from the area? Are they going to report the crime to law enforcement? And what happens when they go in to talk to law enforcement? Who has control of the finances in the family? Are they going to be left without money? How do they keep track of their funds? Who else is involved in their family? How can they protect the other family members that they can have? So you can imagine somebody in this situation has many, many things to juggle. And while certainly I'm sure they would much better be at work than have to deal with all these difficult situations, they do need time. And safe time would give them that ability to deal with these issues. A couple of other important points I wanted to make, particularly access to these services and legal services, are really a big part of improving the lives of victims of sexual assault, stalking, and domestic abuse. This is what helps to get them back up on their feet and to heal. Also, we don't want people to be placed in the impossible choice between their paycheck and their safety or their family's safety. So if they can have some time to go out and deal with these particular situations and then be able to come back to work later, they're going to be a better asset to the employer and be able to take care of their families. We believe that this legislation is a start toward fixing this problem, and we hope that workers could really benefit from this, so we really appreciate taking a look at it. And we also find that this is a win-win for employers and employees, because when we make sure that our employees are safe, they're able to work, the employers can be sure that their worker is safe at their workplace and that they're able to get their work done. Really, I think everybody's goal is to make sure that we have healthy and productive employees. And as the law and policy manager at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, we always like to see legislation that supports the victim in their healing process and leads them back to self-sufficiency. So we really appreciate your time looking at this bill and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Palmer, for your testimony. And Senator Wicklund, oh, Mr. Gerber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I want to thank Senator Wicklund and the advocates for working on this. I really appreciate all the work. I know Senator Wicklund spent a lot of time on this bill, and so we really do appreciate what's been done, and we're supportive of the changes. And so I just wanted to make sure that the committee was aware of that. I'm Ben Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I think there's two little technical issues that I want to bring up, and this shouldn't take away from the fact that we support the content of the bill. On line 1.26, and I know this came up last year, it's not new language, and I wonder if Mr. Fuller has, we're not sure if to saying no less than, we thought maybe up to 160 hours, but again, we're open to just a drafting issue. And I think one thing that I noticed, the effective date was deleted from the delete all amendment. And so I think, you know, I don't know if that was on purpose. I think one of the things, and this would really only be the only substantive comment, is much like the bill before, giving HR people and human resources, or for businesses that don't have a human resources, some time to update their policies and make sure that they're aware of these changes. These take a while to get out to employers, and I think most employers that I've spoken to do make accommodations for their employees in these situations, and we hope that they would, especially with this change in law. So with that, I don't know if it's appropriate to have Mr. Fuller comment.
No, it's not.
Oh, okay.
But I think he was listening.
Yeah.
But Mr. Fuller does have a suggestion. Maybe Senator Wicklin, if you want to.
Oh, that one. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, just to be consistent on line 1.16, safe, change that to safety, because that's the term we use throughout the bill. Not a big deal, but it's consistent. So I would think you'd want to change the quoted phrase there to safety leave, not safe leave.
Do you hear that, Senator Wicklin?
No, I'm
okay.
Sorry.
I'm
what
sorry.
Line?
Senator Wicklin, on line 16, the term, in the middle there in quotes, it says safe leave, but the term we use is safety leave. So we might as well use safety leave as a defined term as well.
It's a conscious decision.
I mean, if you look on page 1.12, safety leave, I think every reference is to safety leave. So we might as well define it as safety leave.
Senator Wicklin?
Yes. Yeah. Chair Sparks, that would be acceptable.
Okay.
Do you want me to comment on that more or less than or not?
It's up to you if you want to.
That's right.
Yeah, go ahead. Just say that's right.
Mr. Chairman, members, it is confusing the language on 1.26 that says lesson, but if you understand what the intent was, it's crystal clear, which is you can limit it to more than 160. So if somebody has $400 vacation, an employer could say, I'm limiting it to 240. But if they have, you can't limit it to 160. But in all instances, there's no grant of sick leave under this section. It's whatever you earn. So the employer is not compelled to give you any more. This is actually a limiting. So if you have $300 of sick leave, the employer can say, well, this leave for relatives, you can't use it as fully as you could use it for yourself. So that's what it does.
Thank you for the clarification. Then, Senator Herr, would you move that on line 1.16, we delete the word safe and insert safety?
Yes, I move.
Okay. On Senator Herr's motion, oral amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Further discussion on Senator Wicklin's bill. Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair. Senator Wicklin, thank you so much for bringing this forward. When I first was in the legislature, I brought forward legislation to respond to a tragedy that happened in my community. A Hopkins High School teacher lost her sister to, a domestic violence incident. And we created the Terry Lee Law to make sure that the photos of the offender were on the no-contact order so that community members can see who the offender is. And you talk about this, and I just am moved to tears because I've watched the impact of that on this woman and her family, and she's now taking care, because the father was also deceased, of that, you know, I think she had four children. She has, so they, you know, anyways, these stories, they're countless stories. And so anything we can do to support these people and getting on their feet and getting the help that they need, I'm grateful. So thank you.
Senator Wicklin, I too want to thank you. I know that you put a lot of work into this bill, and we appreciate your efforts. So any further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Bonoff moves that Senate file 2006 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Wicklin. The bill is passed.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Sparks and the committee. I appreciate it.
Committee, Senator Pappas is going to come forward, but we had on Senator Dibble's Senate file 2727, if we could move to reconsider. The reason is that actually Senator Pappas's committee had requested to see it,
okay.
But because of the delete all amendment, that section of law was taken out. So do we need to have a motion to reconsider Senate File 2727? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no. Okay. Senate File 2727 is before us, and now a motion. And now we need a motion?
Yes.
Okay.
Pass it and refer
to. Okay, now we need a motion that Senate File 2727 as amended is recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Dibble. Senator Pappas, we just eased your load a little bit.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. I don't know what you did. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. of the very excited citizens we have out there in the lobby, we have to speak loud.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, because this bill has been heavily negotiated, could you pass out the A-15 amendment?
Certainly.
So that people know where we're at with the bill? And while it's being passed out, I'll just say a brief few words because I know it's getting late. And
Senator Pappas, just so we're clear, we have an A-14 amendment. Is that the correct document?
I have an A-15, so I don't know.
Okay, hang on just a second.
Does it say page 1, line 18? The A-14 amendment is... Oh, yes, we have an A-14 and we have an A-15.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
It's basic bill. What's your term? Okay. So we have the A-14 in front of us.
And Mr. Chairman, depending on the comfort level of the members, we could amend the A-15 onto the A-14 before we adopt the A-14.
I haven't seen this.
Oh, John did this?
It's the same okay. Amendment.
And there's an A-18 now.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
That's what she wants, the A-14.
Yeah, I want the A-18.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, we could adopt the A-18 onto the A-14 and then adopt the A-14, and then that puts the bill in the negotiated shape.
This is not the first committee, though, is it, Senator Pappas?
Oh, she has to move the A-14.
Let's move the, would it be okay to move the A-14 and then we'll work off that document?
Then move the A-18 right after.
If the members are willing to.
Okay. Senator Bonhoff will move the A-14 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The A-14 amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, if Senator Bonhoff wants to move the A-18 now.
Okay, let's make sure everyone has that. Senator Bonhoff will move the A-18 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The A-18 amendment is adopted.
Okay, thank you very much, members and Mr. Chairman. This is part of the Women's Economic Security Act package, and it came together from a group of from research from the Minnesota Women's Foundation and from the Center for Women and Policy Studies at the Humphrey, and a variety of stakeholders in the women's community and activists because of the stubborn a wage gap between men and women that has persisted over the last two decades, where women are earning about 80% of what men are earning. And the goal with this bill is to see, first of all, if businesses that contract with the state at a rate of $500,000 or more and at 40 or more full-time employees, if they are complying with existing laws around equal pay. Because perhaps... we don't know the pay gap is due to noncompliance with existing laws. The other half of the bill is really an information gathering approach to just understand how businesses in the private sector determine what level of wages and benefits to pay their employees. So the process is that a business is going to apply for an equal pay certificate, pay $150, and submit a statement to the Commissioner of Human Rights, who's here with me, if they're, you know, for any technical information about how that works. They are now required to do an affirmative action statement, and we are trying to streamline the process so that it's very similar to what they already have to go through. And then we create the ability of the commissioner to audit if there seems to be some issues or if there's a complaint. Before we go into deeper in the bill, I'd like to introduce Patty Tangi, who is a labor lawyer that works on these issues, and she has just some personal comments she wanted to share with you of examples that we're talking about.
Ms. Tangi, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Sparks and members of the committee. My name is Patty Tangi, and I own a company called Open Workplace, LLC. I'm testifying in support of Senate File 1806. I own a business called Open Workplace, and I consult with women on how to frame, ask, and get pay raises. I'm here to tell the story of a client who wishes to remain anonymous. She works for a construction firm here in Minnesota and had access to the payroll data. She's a valued employee and partners with her company leadership to make strategic decisions for their firm. Even though a full-time valued member of the management team, she was paid less than the male construction supervisors working seasonal part-time work. Once she decided to move forward asking for a pay raise, which is a courageous act, we put together a proposal to call the attention to her management team the tremendous value she was adding to her company. Once the firm realized that she was actually doing the money doing once she was what she was actually doing, the money she was saving the firm, the revenue she generated, the amount of expertise she was bringing to the table, they all agreed that she was underpaid, and she now earns $20,000 more than she did before she put forward the proposal. She gets mileage reimbursement and a higher percentage of contributions to her 401k plan, just like the male supervisors who are working part-time year-round. So my point is that there is unintended bias, especially in this company who absolutely adored this employee, and it wasn't until she brought it to their attention that she was underpaid that they agreed to give her a pay raise. And I also wanted to call attention to a 2012 Bloomberg report, which is entitled, "Is Our Gender-Based Pay Gaps a Thing of the Past?" They discovered that the majority of HR professionals, 82% in fact, did feel that there was an issue and that there were pay gaps. However, only 16% agreed that they existed in their own company. So my point, again, is really that it's time to start looking under the hood and evaluate and determine our own pay practices within our contractor pool. So thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you very much, Ms. Tangi. Senator, Commissioner, did you have something that you wanted to add?
Mr. Chairman, it's really up to if members have questions. I have to say that I spent several hours with the stakeholders yesterday, and there are a number of things in this A14 that were issues that they brought up, and the A18 is also a result of those discussions and those negotiations.
Thank you, Senator Papps. I, too, want to thank you. I know that you've been working very hard on this bill as well.
And I really want to thank all the stakeholders who've been involved with this and the business community. I know it's always tough to agree to regulate yourself, and I really appreciate them taking the leap forward on this.
Okay, thank you. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one question and then a couple comments. Regarding the last bill, we talked about where the statute was placed, and I'm wondering if this, if 363.8.44, is that in the human rights statute?
Senator Nelson and Chairman and members of the committee, what we would be doing here is we would be creating a new subdivision within the Human Rights Act. So there is no currently 44, so this would be a new subdivision added to the act.
Senator Nelson.
Well, I actually don't have any comments on that at this point because it's so new. I just don't know if our previous comments would apply to this or not. But basically, I just really wanted to thank Senator Pappas for working so hard on this bill to get it in a shape that really, I think, gets to the point that something that I think we all agree on. We want to close the gender pay gap, and what's the best way to do that? And we want to make sure that our businesses are competitive in Minnesota and not at some sort of disadvantage because we might have good intentions, but they didn't turn out that way. And so I really appreciate the hard work that you've done on this. And I really look forward to hearing back from my employers and job providers in my community. It looks to me like you've addressed all the issues that were brought to me. I'm not sure about this particular one as far as the statute, and I'll certainly check back with my community on that, but I look forward to working with you as this goes forward and make sure that we do achieve the intended outcome and not something that was unintended. So thank you for your hard work on this.
Thank you for your comments.
Thank you. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, echo those thoughts. Thank you very much, Senator Pappas, for how gracious you are when being hit with people who disagree. I do appreciate that. And I also want to thank those who have been involved. And in particular, I even have my big corporation representatives here who are saying, yes, we can work with this. I have Twin West Chamber of Commerce is here, and I don't often see them in my hearing room. So you've brought a large group together. And then I thank the advocates because they've been working very hard on all sides of this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I also want to personally thank Commissioner Lindsay because he took a real personal interest in this and tried his hand at drafting legislation and really helped us with the technical implementation issues because of his experience with administrating the affirmative action laws for so many years. Well, you haven't been here so many years, but they've been here many years.
Thank you very much. Further discussion on Senate File 1806. Seeing none, Senator Bonhoff moves that Senate File 1806 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you
Pappas.
Very much.
Do you think it's okay?
Senator Sieben, thank you for your patience. Senate File 1740, the last bill on the agenda for today.
$150 to get a certificate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Members, the bill that's before you today, Senate File 1740, proposes to get at this issue of increased theft of cell phones that is occurring around the state of Minnesota and around the country. Here in Minnesota, the issue has received pretty significant attention, particularly because of some of the thefts that have occurred at the University of Minnesota on their campus, where cell phone theft accounts for two out of three robberies that occur. So I introduced the Senate File 1740 that, as members will see, had quite a bit of language in it that would have said that new cell phones that are manufactured in Minnesota have to meet these certain requirements with the aim or the goal of preventing, not really preventing, but of trying to discontinue the practice of people stealing cell phones so that they can then sell them at a different point. The goal then of this is to install some sort of kill switch technology. And so I've worked pretty extensively with the manufacturers of cell phone companies, the people who work on the networks, and the A5 amendment is the result of some of that those discussions. Article 1 specifically defines what smartphones are, and then and there's an exclusion, by the way, for e-readers. And then it requires that smartphones sold or purchased in Minnesota must have anti-theft functionality. And as you'll see, members, it gets away from some of the more prescriptive language that was in Senate File 1740, just because we were having a hard time coming up with language that worked for the industry because of their they can speak to why if they'd like to. And so the A5 amendment makes the section effective July 1st of 2015, so that smartphones made or sold after that date would need to have this anti-theft functionality. And then the second section of Article 1 is the report where the manufacturers, the operating system providers, would report to you, Mr. Chair, and the minority members on how they're coming with being able to provide this type of service or to provide this functionality as of July 1st of 2015. And then Senator Dietzick is here because the second article of the bill is the bill that she passed through your committee, and we really see these two pieces moving hand in hand to help stop the theft, help do something to stop the theft of cell phones. And members, I would just point out that, or I'd say I'd like to really thank the industry for working with me on this language, and point out that Minnesota is one of the first states that's looking to pass this type of legislation, and so other states are looking to Minnesota to be a model for what they want to implement, which kind of which again goes back to why we're being more broad in our language that's in Article 1 of the A5 Amendment.
Thank you very much, Senator Sieben. I think Mr. Fuller has maybe a change we need to make in the title.
Mr. Fuller. I don't have a smartphone. I have an email phone. But at 1.4, I probably should say smartphone and not email phone.
And Mr. Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, if this is the first stop the committee that the bill has made, I also understand that there's another amendment.
Let's make that change first.
Can we make that change first before we...
Please.
Senator Sieben, okay. Senator Schmidt will move down line 1.14. We delete email and... 1.4, I'm sorry. Delete email and insert smart. On Senator Schmidt's oral amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The oral amendment is adopted. Okay. We haven't adopted it. So, haven't?
You have to do that.
Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, if you could please allow Senator Dietzick to speak to another amendment that's modifying Article 2, which is her section of the bill.
Okay. Maybe let's, before we get too far along, let's move on the A5 amendment, and then we can start to work after that, okay? So Senator Schmidt will move the A5 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. The A5 amendment is adopted. Okay, now, Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I got through your committee, so thank you very much, and two other committees. The House was having a few more issues, and so Senator Sieben, because they do fit together to help us here in Minnesota hopefully stop some of the thefts or prevent some of the thefts. And so as I continued having discussions on my bills with the different industry organizations, the A6 amendment is some additions that we want to put in to just tighten it up even more. And it's based off of the A4, but it should kind of work.
Okay.
So
I think Mr. Fuller said that maybe we can change that to the A5 in line 1.2.
Yeah.
And then it
yeah.
should work. Okay.
Yeah, it should work.
So do members understand that? Okay. Then Senator Schmidt will move the A6 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The A6 amendment is adopted. Okay. Would anyone from the industry want to speak on this? I know they've been working very hard as well. Okay, Senator.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome
Paul Wirtz, State President for AT&T Minnesota. I want to thank Senator Sieben and Senator Dietzick on behalf of my company for working this legislative solution. I'd like to add, I believe we had some packets distributed earlier today. My company and the wireless companies are very much aware of the problem of cell phone theft. A couple of weeks ago, my company in Minneapolis joined with Sheriff Stanek in announcing a Protect My Cell Phone initiative here in Minnesota. That was very well received. We're committed to doing that statewide, and in fact, that has the potential, from my company's perspective, to really take that nationally. So we think the getting on the street and getting the cash component out of out of the cell phone transactions that are taking place, the continuing consumer education that we're committed to. And I will also add that the stolen phone database that just went into effect in November will be a very active tool for law enforcement. Once those phones are reported on that stolen phone database, they cannot be activated by another carrier's network. So that's really kind of a number of components that will get at this problem. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Mr. Wirtz, I want to thank you. I know that we've had several discussions, and I know that you've worked very hard with both the authors to try to come to some kind of a resolution, because we know it's an issue, but thank you for all your hard work.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 1740? Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Steven, Senator Dzitzik, I just, as Chair of Higher Ed, want to thank you on behalf of the students, because, you know, there is a very serious issue, as we heard in our Senate hearing over the interim, which Senator Dzitzik, you participated in, and I know it's your community. So, Senator Sieben, thanks for your leadership on this. I continue to get emails from students asking about this, and so we're going to be having in my committee next week a safety update, and we'll make sure to have this be part of the discussion.
Very good. Any further discussion, members? If not, thank you, Senator Dzitzik and Senator Sieben. Then Senator Schmidt moves that Senate File 1740, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. I want to thank you, committee members. We had a lot of work to do today, but I think we got some good work here. And with that, the meeting's adjourned.